But there I ran out of tape. But here we go again. We're now standing under the big Torrey Pine in the children's playground, and I mentioned to you that this was the biggest one known in New Zealand anyway, and possibly could be the biggest in the world. A magnificent specimen. Every May, the cones split and the seed comes down here, and if you're cute enough, you can come along and pick up your own pine nuts. An incredible thing happened on this tree a few years ago when they had the lights. There was a big floodlight attached to there. We see where that piece of bark is coming off. There was a floodlight attached there for the summer lighting, and a cable came down to the power supply. Lightning struck away up in the top of the tree on this branch around here, and it came down, it sprung across to there, came down to the lamp, blew the lamp, and that was all. It didn't even burn out the cable underneath. It's a very, very rare thing to happen. And so that's the strike of lightning down to that point. Fortunately, it's not lethal for the tree. We have it sometimes where it'll, you know, that's the end of the tree. But that's a piece of lightning strike there.
Gee, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Well, looking back at the playground, you can see the significance now of an open space. How you can stand back, you can see back towards the water, pardon me, the water wheel, you can see a kauri. Now, the kauris were not native to this area, of course, but they do grow very well here, and they're quite significant in our... Oh, yes. So, now, Gordon has brought me some cones, or brought over some cones, and that is the size of the seed of Pinus torreyana. Now you crack that open and there's quite a big kernel in there. So that was a Red Indian delight. again, we look again at some interesting native trees from here. There's a big karaka in the other side of the playground, and we now at the we're almost on the Hughes Walk end of the side of the playground. We're standing under a titoki, which is another native tree, which has very, very interesting fruits. I don't know whether we're lucky enough to see one on the ground, but they are brilliant black and red. It's not a particularly well-known native tree, but it has interesting characteristics. So I'll take you now, we'll go back along this way a little bit to see the entrance gates at the Victoria Road entrance. The tree we're passing under here, just still within sight of the playground, is a heenau. Heliocarpus dentatus. Now that's not a terribly important tree in our history, I suppose, but the bark of it is used for dyeing, as a natural dye. And there's no other big specimen of it, to my knowledge, in the park. So again, we've got a possum bait station up there. And you'll see where the naughty electricians have put up an attachment for their cables when they do the lighting in the park. And they must have forgotten to take it down. So if that's not taken off reasonably soon, we'll be starting to be affecting the growth of the tree. We won't go down to the gate, but I want you to have a look at it, because that is the ironwork, or the wrought ironwork, of the original main gates. Now, we've got to put the whole thing into context here. I told you before that this was the original main entrance to Pukekura Park because of those problems with Liard and Phyllis Street. And this is where people would have come into the park in those days. Now, you see how beautifully level this walk is. This is Hughes Walk we're standing on. as it goes into the distance towards the kids' playground and the main lake and the waterfall, it's almost dead even, because Skinner, was it W.T. Skinner, I think his name was? W.H., was it? Yeah, there might have been two of them. We've got to be a bit careful. Anyway, he was a surveyor, and he was a clever man, did a lot of surveying in Taranaki, and he surveyed this so that it was going to be dead. And it comes right to the level of the top of the dam that they built in 1878 to make the main lake. It's almost level all the way through. It's magic. Now, of course, when the... I'm getting really hoarse. I might not last out. when the proposal was made to put tram cars into the town, Vogeltown was in existence, of course, and they tried to figure out how they'd get up to Vogeltown, and this was the only way they could get up with a level run that a tram car would be able to negotiate. So there was a proposal early on in the history of the park that this be the tram car route up to Vogeltown. So it could have been a very different park altogether, couldn't it? Because I guess once you got a tram car line into it that was working, it would have been pretty difficult to get it out. So anyway, that didn't quite go through. But when you walk through Hughes Walk, you'll understand the significance of that. I mean, it's wonderful for cyclists. Just imagine you're coming up from town and you live up Torbay Street where I live, and... if you don't come up this way, so through the park and walk, of course, you have to walk up the hill, and then you go down the hill to Brooklands Drive, and you go up the hill again. So this is beautiful. It's a magic trip all the way through. There's a few other significant things here. If you look back at the early maps of New Plymouth, you will find that that road up there is Carrington Road. And then what we now know as Carrington Road is Victoria Road. And I still haven't really quite figured out how and why it was changed, but they have transposed the names of the two streets in the course of history. The other interesting thing is that, you know, I can't put a date to this either, but, and it's not, I mean, I think it's within living memory, this Victoria Road did not exist here because of the steepness and danger of this part of the road. To get into Victoria Road, you had to come in from Shortland Street here. And this was relatively recently put in. And I'm given to understand by somebody, and I can't remember who it was, but I think his father worked on the development of that. And some of the spoil, and it's understandable, some of the spoil that was taken off to form it, formed the culvert in Gilbert Street, which is recently caused the trouble. And that's pretty logical, isn't it? That would be a good place to dump it down. I'm not certain about that, but anyway, that's what I think. Now, the other interesting thing that I presume from here, and I, again, haven't proven it, but when we later go, no, that's not today, believe me, when we take the next stage in the centre part of the park, near the Poets Bridge, I'll take you to see the rifle range, the end of it, the target area for the rifle range, which existed in this valley before it was set aside as a reserve. And obviously before the land wars, the local militia used this valley as a rifle range. And they had what, and Scanlon mentions it, a 400 metre range. Now, 400 metres from the Poets Bridge comes to about here somewhere. And I think that their firing position for that range must have been where Victoria Road is now formed. As far as I can see, again, I haven't done that technically, but it you know, measuring it out on the map, it has to come somewhere here. Now, I know, and I'll show you hopefully as we go back, one of the firing positions just below 25 Victoria Road, which very, very few people know about. Anyway, oh, I go to walk up here when I go. Still upsets me this, yeah. In their wisdom, somebody decided that path was no longer suitable, And it's been superseded by a shorter path. Now, in their wisdom, they didn't realize that by shortening the distance between this level and the top level, you have to increase the gradient. Yeah, so we have a rather steeper access. But anyway, that's... there have been some submissions in more recent times to reinstate that track. There is an accepted disadvantage in that track, and that is that, you see, one of the problems with coming into the main entrance to the park, if you're coming with children to the playground here, and there's a big sporting activity on, you have difficulty getting anywhere near this area at all. And one of the possibilities was parking up there. Now, this older track down here, it doesn't link with the playground nicely, you know, and it didn't link with any movements this way and up. So that had a disadvantage. But we found out that it could be... we got a little bit further along. It would have been quite acceptable it had been turned around there and brought back down here. And then you're really right in the centre of things, the access to it. And that could still have been done up until a few months ago, to come down here, you see. And it could have been organised in such a way that the gradient would have been acceptable, and still less than the gradient of this new one. So, anyway... I have to say something too about the development of all these great sophistications. If you watch kids play, these towers that are built don't really mean a great deal to them. They have to have time to enjoy those sort of things, and there's never time here, you know. And I've felt that they were sort of a development that was a bit over sophisticated. And when I have asked this was my kids' backyard, you know, playground. And when I've asked them what they enjoyed most about the playground, do you know what it was? Well, they had clear trees to climb at home, and there was some wonderful things. Rolling down this bank. Rolling down this bloody bank. Something as simple as that. And now we've got a botanic garden here. It's you know, it's the subtleties. There are so many subtleties in children's lives. I meant to show you when we... talked about the bridge over there. There was at one stage a concern about kids climbing up on it and, you know, falling over onto the water wheel. And that's very real. I'm not trying to minimize that. And I watched the kids, and what the kids were wanting to do was not climb up, because there was a mesh along. We knew we'd have to stop them sort of climbing through it. It wasn't the climb up. Wasn't the climb up that they wanted to do. They wanted to take leaves and throw them through and watch them float down the thing. They didn't want to go up. They wanted to go down, for goodness sake. And I was told that we would have to screen off the whole bridge, you know, and I said, look, no way. What those kids are wanting to do is get underneath, and if you put something near that's solid, they'll climb over it all right, because they'll do it. And you'll notice now that the bridge has got a gap like that so that the kids can bob down and chuck their leaves underneath. But it's simple little things like that that, you know. Okay, so I hope you've left your pram at home, and we are now starting to climb the new... staircase to Victoria Road.
Down here, kids throw stones at me from up there, so I got the big black case out. It's handed up as a raise that phone. Ring the police.
Yeah. Now, this is a development. Yes, somebody has asked me where these stones or blocks have come from for forming the steps up this path. Any stone shaped like that with three at least two good sides to it. There's a curbstone from the town. See, they don't make curbstones anymore. They just put concrete beads in. And the curbstone's an embarrassment. They're irregular and all that sort of thing. So they pull them all out in most places in the town. And we've had them over the years, stockpile them in different places where they could be used for landscaping work. And they certainly have that character, don't they, of being a little bit rustic. But they are invariably, in fact, I think in all cases, built, constructed, if you like, or hammered out over in the quarry at the police, at the prison, New Plymouth Prison, here. And so they have served, you know, extra purposes. And it'd be a shame to have anything like that dumped. Well, as we climb this gradient, we are venturing into Japan in terms of the vegetation. Most of this material has originated from Japan. This was one of the last big blocks of pines to go out. See, I think I mentioned to you that it became necessary to take pines out. And there's it's not practical to mess around. You can't take two trees out and sort of plant something up and then knock another two out in 5 years' time. They are so destructive when they come down that you have to fill them in a block. You fill a few of them and then you fill all the rest into that area and the whole lot are gone, and then you clear it up and plant again. And this is a pretty good example planting to a theme. This is a Japanese theme in terms of the vegetation, the origin of the vegetation. So we have aces on this side for autumn colour, and chamois cypress there, which we're familiar with as many forms of those plants, which are decorative. And further up there you have the principal forest tree of Japan, a Japanese cedar or Cryptomeria japonica, growing at an incredible rate, wonderful growth. So what we don't see perhaps are some of the views, which I think were a feature of this top track. You get a wonderful oversight of the whole of this area.
Are we going to the top?
The lifespan of a Norfolk pine, it's very, very considerable. Well over 100 years in New Zealand anyway. We don't really know, because there are trees that were planted in the 1850s and they're still looking pretty good. Mm. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I'm looking up there. I was asked yesterday if I knew of any unusual Orichaceas. Now, the Norfolk pine is an Orichaceae, and we see three of them. Is it three of them, skyline trees above us there? That's the Victoria Road frontage. We're only, as the crow flies, probably 30, 40 metres from Victoria Road. And believe me, those trees up there are exceptionally important to Pukekura Park in terms of wind protection, because that's where the southwesterlies, westerlies and northwesterlies come into the park. And those tough old Pohutukaras up there are doing an incredibly good job. Now, we've got three Norfolk pines going up through them, but this character here, which looks a little bit like a Norfolk pine, to the right there, a little bit closer to the kids' playground, that is Orichaceae clinkii, which is rare in New Zealand anyway, because it comes from New Guinea. It's a New Guinea member of that family. And it's only yesterday I met a chap in town, and he asked me if I knew of any unusual Orichaceas, and I said, well, you know of the Orichaceae clinkii? I said, there's one planted at the Bowl of Brooklands, as you look down from the car park there. And I remember years at the same time we planted one in Pukekura Park, and I hadn't actually checked on it for a while. Now I know that it's really doing well. And it was a very, very weak sort of thing. So coming from New Guinea, we didn't really think they'd do here. So anyway, that's a rare rarity.
Yeah.
Now, you will have to believe me, but and you can prove it if you like, but there we can see the old track just up through there, and there's a wonderful vista. You see, vistas are so important that we must try to preserve them. There's a wonderful vista there, right down onto the fountain, which is now going to be lost by the fact that we're too low to see it anyway. And even, you know, up there, there should be an avenue cut through those trees to reveal that vista. And I, when this had been proposed, I didn't know this was going to be built, but I proposed that, you see, one of the problems with that lookout over the fountain is, how the hell do you get to it? If you saw it where we do, and you think, oh, that's a lovely place up there, I'd like to go up there, how do you get there? Look, here's a native pigeon going across. Yeah. And I have proposed that, you see, you can't get easily this way. There you can see the top of the fountain, incidentally, over the trees now that's working. Well, from up there you can see down the whole thing. Anyway, I propose that another link should be made with Hughes Walk down to the corner of the of Fountain Lake area, so that you come one zig there, then you go zag there, and you go zig here, you go zag there, and then you go zig there. And you retain the old route through with that modification at the bottom. Then you can justify this path through here. But this is not a very practical means of getting people with pushchairs and things down to the kids' playground from Victoria Road. Now, this is the growth of these Japanese cedar here is absolutely unbelievable. I mean, they've only been planted a few years. You know, you bring the people from the native habitats of these trees here. And, there was something else that somebody came, and they just wouldn't believe that they were the age of, I don't know, it was cherries or something. Somebody came from somewhere and wanted to see how fast things grew here, and, you know, they couldn't believe it. It's just totally mind-boggling for them. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I love these old stones.
Oh, they're wonderful, aren't they? Oh, the stones are. They will, you know, they'll be there forever, too. They're great. Now, we've climbed the. Up from the children's playground towards 25 Victoria Road, and we've come to the famous lookout overlooking the. Overlooking the fountain.
Oh, that's very, very attractive. Now, wall
safe. I was introduced to this area. You have to remember that this was much more enclosed with vegetation. There were pines right up there up until a few years ago. This was very, very dark. And I was introduced to this lookout by John Goodwin. And John Goodwin was a very, very practical person, very practical indeed. And it was from this point that he could look down on the fountain and make sure that everything was all right. And in my time, subsequently, when I came to be in charge of the park, I realised what a wonderful lookout it was. It's only 25 metres from Victoria Road. And it's true, it's not in a part of Victoria Road where people would normally stop, but I thought at least we ought to make some sort of an effort here. So it was at a time when they were doing some reclamation of the Brooklands Bowl Lake, and Denny Sutherland was in charge of that, and I conned him into letting me have these stones here. These are not stones, they're concrete, square concrete section. I think they're chimneys. I think they're chimney sections. They're concrete chimney sections, and they must have got hold of a lot of those. And he let me have enough to make that mound round there. And it was just a very, very simple mound. And, you know, that was our fountain lookout, which Denny Sutherland thought was absolutely wonderful, you know. And we popularised it as much as we could, put signs out there and so on. Anyway, it's a wonderful place to view the fountain at night. If we didn't have to destroy any trees to open it up. And it's got this wonderful puri here forming oak tree on the other side. And we're actually just about at the height of the fountain. It's quite spectacular at night because you actually look down on the source of the 15 sources of light within the fountain. And you can see the patterns. They're in patterns of three, which you don't see from down below.
Did the rowboats used to go on this lake?
No, it's never been used as for anything other than just decoration. Yeah. All sorts of stories about that fountain, goodness me. Anyway, we won't get into that now. We've been going fairly long. 3:05. Is that the time to stop? Yeah. All right, we've climbed to the limit. It's all downhill from here. We can break into a jog. Now we're at the top of the of that incline, just above the lookout, and it's here where I can show you where this is the intersection with the old path used to come through here, and this is where it would be possible to link with the old path without doing any great deal of costly changing around. Just take this path through there and have a branch to the balcony. Anyway, that's a personal feeling, and I suppose that's as far as it will go now. Now, yes, to put this in, you see, they had to make this awkward rise here and so on. But anyway, that's another matter. At some time, Baden Powell, I think, came to New Plymouth, certain about that, and some cowries were planted. And as far as I can determine, these cowries were planted by Girl Guides or somebody in the scouting movement. It might have been they might not have actually been here. I'm really rusty on this one. But it was something in recognition of Lord and Lady Baden Powell and the scouting movement, that some cowries were planted, and we don't really know which ones they were, but I think they're these ones. You'll notice up on that cowry there, number 86, all of the significant trees in the park are numbered. Wow. We'll probably find another number on that tree there, which is one of the coastal redwoods. That's a pretty big specimen. And you'll see now we're up in the wind. You saw the one behind the pavilion, quite tall and elegant. This one it'll have a flat top because they do not like the wind. And there's another one we're looking a little bit towards 25 Victoria Road now. There's another one there. Look at how thick that one is at the base.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's here near this redwood that I want to show you the relic of the last war. Which was the last war? I'm talking about the Second World War, 39-45. Here we are. Just down off the track here, there is a genuine Second World War slip trench.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Is it genuine?
Oh, it's genuine. I can guarantee it. I can't remember who showed it to me. But No. It's funny how people don't trust me.
I've had that show for years
now. No, it is not a Maori pit. I am given to understand... Yes, all right. I have it on good authority that during the war there were a lot of these formed in Pukekura Park, so that if an air raid occurred in New Plymouth, the community would rush out and take off to Pukekura Park and get into a trench. Well, I mean, it sounds bloody silly nowadays, doesn't it? But that was something real.
They termed them foxholes, I think.
Well, in warfare, yeah, but no, these were slit trenches for air raid.
But one young lady found that it didn't hold a fox, there was a wolf in it.
Anyway, there it is, and it's pretty well protected amongst the trees. So, you know, there we go. Now, somebody has said that somebody else said that it was a Maori, but I'm really breaking up. It was a Maori pit. There is a Maori pit in the park, some distance from here, which I have shown very, very few people. So there is a Maori pit, and there's a slip trench. This is a slip trench. And I don't think I'll show many people the Maori pit. And when I say a pit, it's a food pit. But it's quite some distance from here. And here again we see this very vital protection of tough native trees, pehutukawas, totaras, taking all those westerlies and northwesterly winds. Going back here to the redwood, the name of the botanical name of the redwood is Sequoia. This one is Sequoia sempervirens. The other one, the big tree, is Sequoia gigantea. And both of those names describe something about the tree. Gigantea means that it's big. I didn't have to tell you that. But you may not know that sempervirens means living forever and ever. And the reason this species has that name, you'll notice this bark is very soft and very insulating, and you'll have to believe me, you can't see it, but it'll probably be about 150 millimetres thick. And that means that if a forest fire occurred, or if a fire occurred here, and burnt everything up that you can see, including all the small leaves and branches on this tree, the heat of it could never penetrate to the vital growing area in this tree. It's protected by this very, very thick insulating. And you can see that wonderful camellia, which is about 15 metres across. This open area, of course, is another one of the gems that we can thank John Goodwin for. Many, many horticulturists having an area like this would have thought, oh, God, we'd have some magnificent specimen trees here. But he insisted that nothing be planted here, and I think these two that do exist out there. And there was a third one, a big Magnolia grandiflora out there at one time, but it has died. And all sorts of activities can take place here. And you get these lovely vistas, you know, that sort of so valuable, being able to see a distance through trees and at trees. So there we are. There's a whole story about that little corner in there where the cascade comes down and the construction of those steps up there, which I better not go into now. But I will point out something about this tree here on the corner. This is a kahikatea, the white pine, and we've already mentioned the fact that the timber was clear and clean and didn't have a fragrance, so it was a natural for use for exporting our 56-pound blocks of butter in earlier days. But this tree to me has significance because for several years a pair of pigeons nested in it. Excuse me. A pigeon nest is quite unique. It's just like that heron nest around the corner in the other pine. It's just a whole lot of sticks put together, very, very clumsily indeed. It's so clumsy that I knew when the eggs were laid, I just looked up into the tree and you could see the eggs against the sky. They were visible through the nest, and that's how clumsy it was. And they nested in that kahikatea for several years. Oh, there's a lesser shag flying around way up there. That's a protected shag. It's a river shag in New Zealand. It's not the big cormorant that we see on the coast. And that one is a protected bird. I know that because I wasn't very pleased about the big shags that used to come in and eat all the fish out of the lake, and I shot a few of them. But that one was not to be shot because it's protected. Anyway, going back to the pigeon, when the pigeons are... the squabs, as they're called, are big enough to fall out of the nest, practically. They can't always fly. And this is what people don't realise about protecting some of our native fauna. That it's very, very vulnerable in its early days, because if it comes down onto the ground, as I believe many of them do, it's the most unprotected creature imaginable. It can't fly, and it's juicy, and it's a great prey for cats and dogs and anything. And, you know, any dog tearing through here would find it. So they are very vulnerable in their early days from being a fledgling. And it's hard to tell people with dogs that that's why you're not too happy about dogs running around in here.
They all believe their dog wouldn't
attack. Yeah, I know. It's very... people become more defensive about their dogs than most parents do about their children, I can assure you. I better not go on that subject anymore. We are now looking at the so-called Carrington pine, and I say so-called Carrington pine because in my mind there's a little bit of doubt about it. I have seen, and on the other side, I think next time when we start we'll go to the top of Cannon Hill and recreate the sort of park from there. But I'll just mention here that since we're looking at the Carrington, so-called Carrington pine now, I have a photograph, or I've seen a photograph, of a pine with a big label in front of it. This is the Pinus radiata planted by Jane Carrington on the 29th of May 1876 to commemorate setting aside of the park. And it's on the other side of the hill because you can see the sports ground behind it. So I think somebody might have been pulling out a leg. Anyway, be that as it may, I think no doubt that it is the most magnificent of all of them planted on that day, because there were several. And we better look at it closely and cherish the site, because that pine on the right-hand side there, if it is not already quite dead, is almost dead, and we would be unwise to expect many more years out of the Carrington pine. And that big branch came out on Cyclone Bola, incidentally. But it looks a big tree from here, but you really have to go beside it and put your hands around it and to see what a magnificent specimen it is. Incidentally, underneath it you'll see a kauri tree, and this is one of the great frustrations of my life. It is recorded that Robert Clinton Hughes, who really is the founder of the park, it was he who was the solicitor who in 1875 saw the potential and got people around him to support the idea of setting the place aside as a reserve. He served the board, the committee, for nearly 60 years and died in, I think, 1934. It is recorded that in that year he planted a kauri, and that would be a really special kauri to me anyway, because I have an interest in kauri, but for the park as well. And nobody knows what kauri it is. I'd like to think it's that one growing up under the Carrington pine there, but I don't really know. Because there's another big one just around the corner at the same size. So, anyway, we have that mystery. I know that there is another kauri planted near the top, and it was planted in that commemorative, the centennial planting of 1976. On the other side, we saw the Norfolk pine that was planted by Denny Sutherland, the mayor, and on this side is a kauri that was planted by, I think, Don Saxton. Yeah. He planted the kauri up there, didn't he? I think it was he who planted the kauri. He planted something up there. Remember, it was a terrible day, and all the older person, they absolutely perished with the cold. Dreadful day that day, weather-wise. So here, from this lawn, which is the hatchery lawn, we have the beautiful vista through to the Fountain Lake and the fountain itself. Now, here's where we hit Smith Walk again. Smith Walk starts up beside the bandstand, excuse me, pointing at you like this with this dreadful weapon, but it starts beside the bandstand and sweeps down the hill there, under the hatchery lawn, comes around here, and then goes around the fountain lake, past the pump house, and then we pick it up again as we come through from the sports ground, and it continues on down as we walk through to Gilbert Street. That is the Smith Walk. It's a little bit tortuous, but it was intended that it should pick up many of the plants which it was believed Smith would have actually planted in his time here. So now we're picking up the Smith Walk and walking back towards the fountain pump house. We come to another historical tree in some respects. This is the ginkgo biloba. Remember, there's another one down at the far end of Smith Walk that we talked about, just near the water wheel. This is supposed to be ginkgo biloba fastigiata. A fastigiate tree is supposed to be one that grows very erect and narrow. And this, is to me, is the most unfastigiate form of ginkgo biloba I think I've seen, so I think we might have got swindled there. It is really going out horizontally, isn't it? And we didn't want it to do that. It was put here specially so that it wouldn't intrude too much into the potential views from the top of Cannon Hill down onto the Fountain Lake. It's doing exactly what we didn't want it to do. It was incidentally, as far as I recall, planted by Fred Parker on the centennial day in 1976, when these other trees were planted, well, some other trees were planted around Cannon Hill, you know, sort of duplicating. And incidentally, they used the same spade on that day that was used by Jane Carrington in 1876. It's still in the museum and was brought out for that special planting. This tree beside it is another significant tree which I was responsible for obtaining. That is the shagbark hickory. It's one of the most beautiful autumn-coloured trees in our area. There's a big one, a massive one up in the Maranui Gully in Brooklands. But hardly anybody sees it. It's a glorious tree. So I got another one and got it put in Pukekura Park. It's competing a little bit with this ginkgo, but never mind. Perhaps we can do some trimming on the ginkgo at some stage so that they'll both be happy. Now, here's another of the kauri, you see, which is one of these tantalising ones that could have been planted by dear old Robert Clinton Hughes. So there we go. Now, I mentioned my secret routes to overlook any mischief taking place around the pump house, because we used to have people breaking into it and doing all sorts of stupid things. One time we even had a character found a steel rod and was going around smashing these lights with a steel rod. And well, yes, the only thing that I regret, didn't bloody well succeed in earthing it through himself. You're not supposed to have dreadful thoughts like that about people, are you? Now, these, you'll notice that we have passed, we're nearly getting near the pump house now around the corner, and you'll notice that we're passing under some wonderful remus. They're all very fine specimens, and we believe that W.W. Smith actually planted these. And, you know, as I say, this is why Smith Walk was continued on, so that it took in as much as possible the elements that he would have been responsible for. Yes, somebody's picked up the silver fern. Isn't that glorious? The silver fern never really comes into its own until you get reflective water underneath it. And the late afternoon light is shining up off the fountain lake, and it's really shimmering, isn't it? Beautiful. Mm. It's almost alive, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now we come. Okay. Oh dear, somebody has made a dreadful mistake. Gordon, I hope this wasn't you. We have there a Japanese cedar, which according to the label is a coastal redwood. No, it is a Japanese cedar. There's a mistake being made. There is a coastal redwood just up behind it there. In fact, there's several of them, so be very careful. Don't take anything for granted, will you? Now, we are standing underneath this English yew, so-called, Taxus baccata. And this may have been one of the trees planted in 1876. It's hard to believe that, but some of these trees don't grow so very fast. And we know that a yew was planted in somewhere around Cannon Hill, and it could be that one. And so we come to the fountain pump house, so-called. All the equipment that was designed specially for this fountain was designed very well. It was designed to last. It'll keep on going for years. It's pretty cumbersome and mechanical. You know, all the controls that are necessary for that thing out there now today would be put into a box about this size, you know. And it only just fits into there. In fact, I made a great mistake when I designed the pump house for the waterfall. I thought, well, that one's big enough, you know. We'll build one about the same size pump, same type of pump, same power. We build about the same sized one. What I didn't realise was whereas this one has incandescent lights, the waterfall has fluorescent, which require much more bulky mechanisms to make them work, and they didn't want to put them into the waterfall, so they decided to put them into the pump house, which means that it's more crowded inside than this one. Now, that might not mean much to you, but if you're somebody who has to lift the foot valve out of the pumping system and repair it as it will replace the seals on it, this has to happen periodically, you wouldn't think it was very funny, I can assure you. And if I had my time over again, I would have done it differently. So here, pipes go into here, and then the water is sucked up, pumped out under pressure. There's a whole system of pipes that go out here, both for the water going out and the lights. There's 15 lights out there, and all sorts of great fun. And down here there are screens through which the water has to be sucked in. And what they didn't realise when they built this, with the pipe having to travel that far, when they put the first one in, it wasn't big enough. In other words, when the pump started, not enough water could come through it to satisfy the demands of the pumping system. And all sorts of funny things started happening, like air being pumped into it. And if air goes into it under pressure and finishes up out there, it just goes pop. You'll sometimes hear it pop. That's air getting into the system somewhere. So it was pretty serious. So they had to put another pipe in. And I'll tell you one problem I had here once, which is a very, very strange thing. There's all sorts of problems have arisen over the years with the mechanism. And, you know, it keeps on testing your ingenuity. And the worst things that happen are the intermittent ones, things that happen sometimes, but not on a regular basis. It'll happen once, you try to repeat it, and you can't get it to repeat that, and you walk away, and it happens. You can't predict it. And that happened to me once with this system, and I couldn't figure out what had happened. Lights down in the chamber, but it kept on blocking up. And what happened is that this confounded Japanese cedar here, that when they had built the second chamber, you know, to surge chamber for the, I told you that the first one wasn't big enough, so I had to put another one in. a little gap had been left somewhere, and one of the roots of this tree had gone into it and then grown out. And you know, it was as big as a dustbin. It was a mass of fibrous roots. The tree was really enjoying it. and it was outside the pump house. The second one was outside the pump house. So what happened, when the pump started, when somebody came and triggered it or put money in or whatever, all this great dustbin-sized mass of roots would come in and block the uptake to the motor. And we'd switch it off to find out what had happened, and there'd be a back surge, and it would disappear back outside the thing. And it took a long while to find out that one. We opened the lid here, and here's this great mass of roots. It was incredible. Amazing. So all sorts of funny little tricks. Well, the tuis are still singing on this lovely afternoon. Oh, incidentally, we think of cherry trees and deciduous trees with wonderful spring flowers and autumn foliage. That is a cherry tree scrambling over the pump house itself. And that's a cherry laurel.
Oh,
Prunus laurocerasus from Europe. And it's significant to us because when you see the Roman... what do you call it? The things are made of leaves. Yeah, they're made of that.
The laurel.
The laurel, yeah.
It's a sign of that.
It's very durable, you know. It's it lasts, so, you know, they could make things of it and it would last the day out sort of thing. So it's another interesting thing. Yes, that's right. Yes, I was recently asked, last Anzac Day, I was asked for some of that to make a wreath. I meant to mention to you too. We were over the other side, and I mentioned the significance of the removal of the pines, the introduction of a great range of plants to benefit birds, notably, and one of the early efforts on my part to encourage that, and was started by John Goodwin, and he advised it, was all the planting of kowais around this lake. These are all deliberately planted for bird fodder, some very frustrating things happen because when you put young trees in, some people have a great desire at that stage, you know, to break them off. And you won't believe the problems. Oh, okay. Now, you'll remember, guys, that you're not allowed to cycle in the park, won't you? You'll just push your bikes. Good on you. Thank you very much. Yeah. Gosh, I used to have some fun here, changing the subject a little bit for a minute. I was very proactive in stopping cycling in the park. My goodness, I just wouldn't let it happen. And time again, I caught people all over the place. And I'd warn them, you've got to be very careful. I would warn them once and ask them if they, no, we didn't know that. So you do know now, don't you? And you went right again. No, of course now. Of course not, you know. And I had done well, you know, as soon as I was out of sight. And, you know, often up in the bandstand area.
Yes.
I'd find them and warn them,
yeah.
And they'd sort of go off towards the one side or the other, and I'd know what was going to happen. And I knew the shortcuts, you see. I'd run down through here, see them going out towards the main gate sometimes. That wasn't so bad, but going down that way, and I'd run down here, and I'd be waiting for them, you know, here, beside the fountain lake.
Yeah.
And I'd say, do you remember me? And I'd match them. If they were young, you know, I mean, some of the older people you couldn't do much about, but
yeah.
I'd match them up to the office and get them to write their names down first and their telephone number. And then I'd say, okay, now, you know who I'm on, the curator of Pugikura Park, and you know that I've stopped you for cycling. I'd like you to just ring your parent up and tell them where you are and why you're here, you see. And that was a good thing because quite a number of times you'd get a false name anyway.
Yes, right.
Or if I wasn't going to do that, I'd I'd say to this one, hey, what's his name?
Oh, right.
That fooled them sometimes.
That did fool them.
Yeah. Or if they were a boys' high school or any school, I'd ask them their name and write it down. Mm-hmm. And then I'd say, can I just have a look at some of your books, please?
Oh, that's a good one.
That was another trip. Yeah. Anyway, I used to run them down sometimes like that. And I'd take them back up to the office, get them to write their names, address and telephone number, and phone their parents and tell them what had happened to them, you know. And they'd ring up very frightened by this stage. You know, the whole thing had been drama, yeah, been going on for a quarter of an hour or something. And they'd say, Mum, I'm in Pukekura Park office with the curator because I've been cycling in the park. I'd say, that's not right, is it? Now, you tell the truth.
Yeah.
That's not quite how it happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, Mum, he told me that I wasn't supposed to cycle in the park, and I did it again. And, you know, most parents thanked me for that.
Yeah, that's right.
That was the end of it.
That's true.
They'd realised the drama of the whole thing.
Yeah.
But, you know.
They're gone,
your idea. Yeah, take you to court. I shouldn't be recording this, but on quite a number of occasions, if it was serious and they'd really, you know, I'd never do it the first time, but I've caught them seriously a second time, I actually confiscated their bikes and gave them a receipt and wrote on the receipt, this bike will be returned to the owner when the parent comes and discusses the matter with me, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, it really meant something.
Because it's no cycling in the park, isn't it?
Well, it's a farce to put it up and not do something about it. I mean, you know. It's just a joke now. Look, until somebody is prosecuted for riding a Pukekura Park, it's nobody's going to take any notice of it. I had occasion here just over the other side of the lake there once where a lady was knocked down by a cyclist and
big wheel, are they?
No, and she demanded his name, and it gave a false name, of course, so, you know, just not taken seriously. Well, now we've got back to the car park, the entrance from the sports ground, and the sun is starting to sink in the west, but it's been great fun. I hope you've enjoyed the whole experience.
Yes, very
and,
really enjoyed it. Hmm, we are going to... Tui, a bit closer. We are going to repeat this. I hope I've got my voice back by the next one. I enjoy it, but I like to use the back chat, really, because I don't have to speak so loud to keep in touch with everybody, but the number was hardly justified on this occasion.
When will we meet one?
Yes, that's a good point.
It's in August.
Mm. Well, of course, if anybody wants to really keep in touch with the whole thing, you can join the Friends of the Park. That's a logical step. But however, we will try to keep the public informed as well as we can. Advertising is quite a problem, of course, but we have good support from whoever.
Oh, that's lovely.
Incidentally, I should mention that the equipment I'm using is borrowed from the museum who are doing audio histories. There is a very interesting exhibition at the moment in the museum of photographs, but they're not usual photographs. They're long panoramic photographs taken by a chap who seems to be relatively little known. And they were taken up to about the 1920s, I think. But they are, I gather that the negatives are about a metre long, and the pictures are only about 150 millimetres high. They're fantastic. And they have enlarged a photograph taken, now I've got to get this right, taken looking down Courtenay Street, and it's featuring the old fire station on the lower side of Courtenay Street, where the petrol station is now, and you can actually see up Liardet Street and down Liardet Street. Wow. So it's covering, I gather, about 200 degrees.
Yeah.
That's beyond, you know, the halfway through. And over here is, and the actual figures on it, it's enlarged to such a size. I think that particular one is enlarged. It must be about 4 meters long. And it's done in a semicircle so that you're actually standing there as the photographer would have done and see the scene that he would have seen looking. You know, if you look that way, you're looking down Courtney Street, if you look up, down Liardet Street, up that way. It's quite fascinating. And the figures on it are about 20 centimetres high. So that's fascinating. And there are many albums there. I mean, they've got a lot of them enlarged on the wall, but many albums you can just flick over the things and see them. So that's an exhibit well worth seeing. There's not a great deal of it, Taranaki, I don't think. I'm not sure about that, but he photographed all over the country. But, my pleasure. I thoroughly enjoyed your company. Thank you very much.
Forward to the next time.
Thank you, Gordon. Thank you.
Yes, most enjoyable. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.